Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, going to be having a chat about a fellow who we know today as a... it's a French name, so I'm going to stuff it up. Tarare? I don't know, T-A-R-R-A-R-E. So, Tarare? I'm just going to stick with Tarare, and again, apologies to all the Francophone listeners out there who know that I'm going to absolutely butcher it at every turn. Anyway, this bloke, right, he is famous for being one of the most voracious and insatiable eaters that the world has ever seen. This bloke would eat anything, not just, you know, boring stuff like, you know, food, not just mediocre sort of attempts at some sort of historical significance by eating his entire body weight in meat, but I'm talking like garbage, wood, stone, even live animals. This bloke was just absolutely mental when it came to food. When it just came to eating. He had a couple of different jobs, if you could call them that, throughout his life. After being kicked out of home at a young age, he was a performer before he joined the military as a soldier. And then he even had a brief go as a spy for the French Revolutionary Army. There's a lot to get across here. But this poor bloke, he went through life in a state of constant hunger, and he never really seemed to be able to eat his fill, no matter what, no matter how much food was chucked at him here. Now this led to some pretty interesting things happening to him. Many of them very, very funny. Some of them quite sad, and a few things are pretty dark as well. His military career, in particular, is very bloody amusing, I can tell you. But there's all sorts of stuff to chat about as well. Before we get to it, however, I just want to warn listeners with delicate sensibilities, or those who perhaps have children listening, that we're not just going to be talking about eating today. We're also going to be talking about the very natural and very necessary consequences of eating. So if you're the sort of person who is put off by a bit of the old poo chat, or if you've got kids listening, you might want to skip this one. And kids, don't forget to sneak back and listen to this episode when mum or dad isn't watching here, because there's lots of just terrific stuff about poo and bums and farts and all sorts of stuff like that. You're not going to want to miss it. So let's get to it. Have a chat about this poor bloke, Tarare, all about what he was all about here. So going all the way back now, all the way back to the 1770s here, probably about 1772 when Tarare is born, or at least when he's thought to have been born. I have to say, we're not sure. We don't have rock solid about information about this bloke's younger years at all. We know that he was born sometime around 1772 and somewhere around Lyon. But that's about it. We actually don't even know his real name. Tarare was apparently a nickname that was given to him, as we'll discuss a bit later on. But even as little tucker, he's going around, he's eating anything he can get his hands on. He's always hungry, he was. He was always wanting more tucker, always wanting to, you know, fill his guts full of stuff here. In fact, when he was a teenager, he was known to have eaten his entire body weight in beef in one day, which is just staggering. There's no satisfying this kid. He eats and eats and eats, which is, you know, normal enough for a teenager, but I guess not normal to the point, you know, he's sifting through garbage just to find enough food every evening. So obviously, you know, he's a little bit more than just sort of raiding the cupboard for, you know, a box of shapes and a couple of fruit roll-ups there. Anyway, unfortunately, his voracious appetite, it actually meant, this is, you know, this is where the story is a little bit sad already. His parents had to kick him out. His parents had to boot him out of home well before he became of age. He's a young teenager, and they simply couldn't afford to feed him. They couldn't afford to feed him, so they booted him out of the house, and they told him to jog on, which is a pretty bloody heartless thing to do to your own kid, I reckon. Poor boy, he just wants a feed. Next thing, he's out in his ass. It's no good at all here. No good at all. Anyway, he found his feet all right, and our boy Tarare, he runs off with a group of rogues and vagabonds, mostly thieves and prostitutes they were, and he's cutting about with them for a while, you know, begging for food, or he's nicking it when begging didn't work. And you got to imagine, considering Tarare's appetite, all that stealing and the begging is obviously never going to be enough to feed him. And sometime after this, he actually ends up getting a job. Well, I don't know, a job is, it's a fair enough term, it was a job, you know, it was perfectly suited to his unique skill set, I guess, because what he did was this. He starts to work as the warm-up act for a traveling performer, some charlatan who would organize these big performances, you know, singing, dancing, all the rest of it, and then have his mates pick the audience's pockets while he was up on stage doing whatever, distracting them, you know, keeping them entertained. And Tarare was one of the people. He got a job as a support act. He'd stand out there and he'd try to draw a crowd. You know, you go through, you know, cities these days and there's the blokes there juggling, or, you know, chucking balls around, doing whatever they're doing, trying to get this crowd together there. And he's doing this by, you know, just standing in front of them and eating, well, basically anything that was on hand. He would eat corks from wine bottles. He'd eat handfuls of stones and pebbles and stuff. He'd even eat live animals if they were forthcoming, which is, I don't even really want to talk about that, to be honest. But the other one that he always would do, the classic Tara party trick here, is he would eat basket after basket of apples. He could fit a huge amount of apples into his mouth, and he'd just chomp down these, just whole baskets of apples, one after the other there like that, and amaze the crowd with his prodigious appetite here. It's just, obviously, no breaks on the Tara train when it came to eating food. And it was perfect for him, this job. It was absolutely perfect, because obviously, not only is he sort of in a properish situation of employment, not only is he earning himself a little bit here, he's also keeping his belly very full indeed, because he's just eating things every day. So he's having a great time. He's going around with his charlatan, going around sort of putting on these performances here, there and everywhere, moving around the place. But after a while, he decides he's had enough of it. He decides he's had enough playing sort of second chomper to this other performer bloke, and he's sick of traveling around here, there and everywhere. So he decides to settle down a little bit, and he moves to Paris in 1788. He's only 16 or 17 at this stage. He's only still a young fella here. Because he wants to become a street performer. He wants to become a street performer in Paris. Obviously, the market for that very lucrative, still is today. If you go there today, still choked with people who want a couple of euros off you there like that. And he decides that he's going to set himself up there and, in a little bit more of a permanent situation, at least, not so transitory. So, doing well for himself in Paris. He's getting his chompers into all types of food, and I also suppose all types of not food as well. He's, again, having a great time. Now, you might be wondering, what the bloody hell is going on with this bloke when it comes to his health and what he looks like, because he's always hungry, always eating. He must have been enormous. You're thinking, how is he even still alive if he's eating rocks and, bits of... I was trying to think of a disgusting food, but then again, he's French, so he's eating bloody snails and frogs and bits of horse and absolutely loving it. It's normal for them, I guess. So, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, apparently, right, in terms of, his health, how he looked, right up to when he was working as a street performer in Paris, as a young fella there, he just looked like a normal fella. He looked like a normal... He was a bit skinny, if anything, which is just baffling to me. Like, he wasn't overweight at all. He was a bit on the skinny side there. Apparently, at 17 years of age, he was only 45 kilograms, which is just unbelievably... it's such a small... very, very small little bloke. And this didn't change. This actually didn't change, despite the fact he's going about, scarfing anything remotely edible and a lot of stuff that also wasn't remotely edible. He just doesn't put any weight on. He's skinny as a rake. It's absolutely ridiculous. But he did run into some medical problems while in Paris, and this actually gives a good opportunity to delve a little deeper into what this bloke sort of looked like and how he behaved here. So this is a good chance for us to sort of answer some of those questions as to what his appearance was here. So, despite seeming normal enough from a distance here, once you got a little bit closer to Tara, you started to notice stuff about him that was a little odd. So, first of all, his skin was super, super stretchy. Really, really stretchy it was. When he hadn't eaten anything for a while, it would hang loosely around his guts. It was actually so loose that he could pull it. He could grab hold of it and pull it around his entire waist like a belt. That's how sort of skinny and stretchy his skin was there. And when he had eaten something, when he was all full up, full as a gook there, it would blow up like a beach ball, right? He'd have this massive, big, distended, enormous stomach with all the food inside of him there like that. So probably it looked a bit like a cartoon character, I'd imagine, there like that, dragging around this massive, big stomach. Unbelievable. But it wasn't just his abdomen that was all like this. It wasn't just his abdomen. The skin of his face was as loose as anything as well. Apparently he could fit 12 apples in his mouth. As I said before, huge amount of apples. He could fit, he used to do these things, put like huge numbers of apples or eggs or something in his mouth there like that to show off. Now, I've got a mate who can fit his fist into his mouth, which is quite something to see. I can assure you from personal experience, it's quite something to see, a man put his fist inside his mouth. And I cannot begin to imagine what it would be like, to see some of Tara's party tricks there. A dozen apples inside this bloke's mouth. He had a great big mouth, he did. It was huge, huge, big thing, gaping, big, great hole with very, very small lips. And horribly stained teeth. Obviously, he hadn't been given the old Colgate treatment there at all, because he's eating every day. He's not polishing his choppers like he should be, which is pretty gross. But when we're getting into the conversation of Tara and sort of gross, disgusting personal hygiene, well, that is just the tip of the iceberg, my friend, because Tara absolutely stank. He smelt so bad, apparently, that being within sort of 10 or 20 meters of him was completely unbearable. He was always hot and sweaty, and it only got worse after he'd eaten something. Apparently, once he chomped his way through some food, he would start to smell even worse than before. His eyes would become bloodshot. Something, and then on top of this, something else would happen. That's just the most amazing thing you can imagine, right? Think of this. You know how in cartoons, right? Cartoons, whatever else, when a character in comics or whatever, when a character's stinking, they show it sort of visually by using them little sort of wiggly lines that come off of them like that. This is not a joke. After Tarar had eaten a big meal, when he started stinking and sweating and all the rest of it, a sheen of vapor would start coming off him. This guy had actual, literal, real life stink lines coming off him. How about that? Can you believe it? Unbelievable. This guy, he was so bloody disgusting. He's sweating and stinking and all that sort of stuff there like that. When he ate, he had actual real life visible stink lines. Unbelievable. Anyway, while we're talking about how he smelt as well, it's worth mentioning the other end of things here, because of course, you know, everything that goes in eventually does have to come out one way or the other. And apparently, this bloke's farts and turds were something from another world. An actual medical doctor once described them as fetid beyond all conception. And when you think of the sort of thing that doctors are seeing, you know, on the reg, imagine how bad it must have been with Tarar for someone to describe it like that. He farted like a racehorse that had drunk champagne. He was an expert in producing unrivaled intensity when it came to both volume and smell. In fact, people think that his name Tarar might have actually come from a French expression at the time, bon bon Tarar, which was used apparently when describing huge big explosions. Imagine being named after your farts. Actually, that'd be pretty good. I'd be called the silent assassin or something like that, I reckon. But when it came, so the farts is just the beginning. That's where it starts here. Because when it came to matters of a more solid nature, I tell you what, when this bloke busted a grumpy, he was squirting out the foulest, most rancid Havana omelets you can possibly imagine. Tarar, he's going about bloody spray painting the porcelain with his high pressure systems, and from what I read, it seemed like he could have done it through a screen door and not had any of the pieces get caught. Oh, okay, sorry. Oh dear. He went around squirting like a country goose, he did. Sorry. Sorry, everyone, this is a serious podcast, sorry. He went about squirting like a country goose, he did, with the old green apple nasty. Okay, I'll get it this time. All right. Oh, he went away. Oh dear. He goes around squirting like a country goose. The old green apple nasties, causing this olfactory death zone after every single one of his dishonorable discharges. Okay, all right. All right, let's go. Going with that. All right, well, but in spite of all this, or perhaps maybe because of it, right, he never gained weight. And as long as you pegged up your nose, he seemed like a perfectly normal bloke, you know, just to look at him there like that. But obviously there is this sort of lingering smell because of all the stuff that we've just talked about in very serious and a very, very serious, mature medical way there. Anyway, as I mentioned, he did run into some medical problems while he was in Paris. One day while he was putting one of his enormously successful street performances on, he topples over in spasms of pain. Very, very bad look at his. He's obviously in a very bad way. So the crowd, they pick him up and they rush him over to a nearby hospital where a doctor named Monsieur Giraud gave him some powerful laxatives to treat what he reckoned was an intestinal obstruction. And he was absolutely right, it was. He was all blocked up there like that. And happily, this treatment was successful. Well, probably not happily for the hospital cleaners afterwards. If you know you're given this bloke who's already blasting off to the moon every now and again, you know, a couple of powerful laxatives, but all the same, it worked, and Tarar was cured. He's very happy about this. And I'll tell you this: when I read through, you know, the different sources about the sort of various topics that we cover here on Half-Arsed History, obviously they're usually very dry. It's what you sort of come to expect from any written materials in the realm of history. It's not the most sort of, you know, scintillating area when it comes to the written word. So usually I have to juice them up a bit, make them a bit more palatable or engaging to listen to, that sort of thing, you know, add a bit of extra sort of colour and flair and that sort of stuff, while obviously staying well within the boundaries of the truth there. But when reading about this incident on Wikipedia, this line had me in stitches. And I tell you what, I'm going to be out of a job if this sort of historical writing picks up, because here's what happened to Tarar afterwards, verbatim from Wikipedia. This is actually what's written on the Wikipedia article, and I thought, geez, this whoever wrote this, absolute comedic genius. Listen to this. He made a full recovery and offered to demonstrate his act by eating his surgeon's watch and chain. Monsieur Giraud, the surgeon, was unimpressed by the offer and warned him that if he did so, he would cut Tarar open to recover the items. To whomever wrote that utterly brilliant bit of prose, I salute you, my friend. What a masterpiece. Anyway, a few years after Tarar had moved to Paris, in 1792 it was, war broke out between France and the Holy Roman Empire, or more specifically, the Habsburg monarchy along with Prussia. Now, this war became known as the War of the First Coalition, and it wasn't really one big war, but actually just a collection of smaller ones that all revolved around France. But that's not the important part here, not important to the story of Tarar here. What is important is that he, as a red-blooded Frenchman, joined up to fight more or less straight away, as you would expect. Now, also, as you would expect, he ran into problems straight away. Immediately, he ran into problems because there wasn't a whole lot of food kicking about while working as a soldier. Obviously, you get your army rations, and that is that. And these rations didn't even come close to the amount that he needed every day. So he used to barter for food with other soldiers by offering to do tasks and duties for them in exchange for, you know, for parts of their rations as well. But even that wasn't enough here. So he started instead to rifle through piles of garbage, just looking for anything, anything at all he could stick in his gob there, anything at all he could possibly eat. Nothing he could do could satisfy his appetite. He was having a terrible time. And not long after he'd signed up, he was actually admitted to a military hospital. He was exhausted and sick and obviously, you know, I don't want to say undernourished, but I guess that's what he was, you know, he just wasn't being able to eat enough here. So after he was, you know, examined and checked out by the doctors, they put him on quadruple rations. Imagine how jealous all the other patients must have been there. But of course, you already know that wasn't enough either. Tarar, he took to eating leftovers from other patients, digging through all the hospital bins, just looking for food, and he even got caught sneaking into the apothecary's stores to eat the poultices that were stored there. It got so bad that hospital staff had to physically restrain him when food was around because he couldn't control his hunger. He ended up provoking the interest of two blokes here. Number one, Baron Percy, the hospital's chief surgeon, and another doctor who took a strong interest in this case here called Dr. Corville, right? Now, Percy and Corville, they started to run experiments on Tarar. One time, one of the things they did was they had a table set with this enormous meal that was enough for like 15 people, and then they accidentally forgot to restrain him, right, to see what he would do. Now, sure enough, he goes straight over to the table here and immediately starts chucking the food straight into his gob. Down Red Lane it goes. He got through two enormous meat pies, 15 litres of milk, and a bunch of salt and grease that was lying around as well, and then went straight into a food coma. He fell asleep straight at the table, just like that, right? And these doctors are looking at, how has this bloke managed to eat so much? It's unbelievable. He's got bloody hollow legs. How is he fitting it all in, right? Percy and Corville, they also did other tests, which, to be honest, we're not going to spend too much time talking about because they're very, very sad and very nasty, where they would offer a variety of live animals for Tarar to eat, and he did, and apparently had a real thing for snake meat, which is quite interesting. But, you know, he ate all sorts of animals, including one time an entire eel, apparently without even chewing, which I don't want to spend too much time talking about that because it's very sad. So let's crack on with the story here. The military wanted Tarar back. They wanted him to come back in service. So they go to the hospital and they want to find out when he's going to be up and about and ready for duty once again here. But Percy and Corville, they've gone deep on this bloke here, and they're not ready to give him up just yet. They want to keep sort of researching him and seeing and finding out more stuff about him, you know, running these experiments, whatever else. So they put their heads together, and they figure out a way to sort of keep him under their not their control, but you know, at least under their oversight here. So what they do? Corville, he goes to General another French name. I'll do my best. Alexandre de Beauharnais. I don't know. Sorry. Anyway, he's the bloke in charge, this de Beauharnais, right? And he suggests, Corville suggests to him and says, listen here, mate, Terrar could be the perfect spy. I reckon he's the perfect candidate to become a secret courier for the Revolutionary Army, right? And de Beauharnais says, well, what are you talking about? How is this bloke going to ferry around documents? What's so special about him? And Corville suggests, he goes, what we'll do, right, Terrar is going to be the perfect person to smuggle documents across enemy lines, because what he's going to do is he's going to eat them, and then later he's going to retrieve them from his, he's going to, look, you know, don't worry about it too much, but basically what I'm saying here is he's going to be able to get you documents to where they need to go, right? So, you know, we've all heard of international smugglers and drug mules and that sort of thing these days, but Corville's idea, obviously pretty groundbreaking, well ahead of its time. This would mean that even were Terrar captured, no amount of searching would find any... You get a butcher's cleaver and sort of anything's fair game, but, you know, no amount of reasonable searching was going to find any secret documents here. So the general, he listened to this plan. He sort of goes, yeah, all right, mate, bit of a weird one, but sure, let's give it a crack here. And he agrees to test Terrar out as a potential courier. So Corville arranges a demonstration for him. Corville puts a document inside a sealed wooden box, which he then gives to Terrar to eat. Chomp, 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 down Red Lane it goes. And to further show the general and his staff just what this bloke is capable of, Corville then wheels out a wheelbarrow with 15 kilograms of raw bull's lungs and livers for Terrar to eat. Terrar is beside himself with joy, goes to town on the raw meat, disgusting, right there in front of everyone, absolutely gross. But after that, just a waiting game for 2 days, as it turns out, before Terrar blasts off with another Bognaughty, and there, amongst the wreckage, is the wooden box. Undamaged. I mean, on a psychological level, probably extremely damaged, but when it, you know, at least as a physical box, relatively undamaged, as I say. So, document still inside, still legible, and General de Beauharnais is ecstatic. He signs off on the plan to turn Terrar into a spy. He's loving it. He's thinking, okay, this is going to be fantastic. He did have one reservation, however, nothing to do with Terrar's ability to eat, obviously beyond reproach, no one's questioning that. He was a bit concerned about this bloke's mental game, as he wasn't sure that Terrar had the right sort of psychological disposition to be a good spy. And as a result, Terrar's first mission was to sneak into enemy territory to a place near Neustadt where a Prussian colonel was being held prisoner. Now, Terrar was told that he would be smuggling documents of great importance, top secret military documents they were, but in reality, they weren't. The message was basically just, did you get this? And if you did, you know, what's going on, mate? How are you? And this was because de Beauharnais didn't yet trust Terrar with important military secrets. As I said, he didn't think he was of the right sort of psychological disposition for it. So this was just a test, and it meant that if he got caught and if the message got found out, he wouldn't be giving away any big secrets or anything else like this. And this decision proved to be very wise indeed, as you'll discover very shortly. So the mission is all set up. One night, Terrar sets off, all dressed up like a Prussian peasant and, you know, stinking like one too, you'd have to imagine. And he crosses over into Prussian territory from the French side of things, trying to, you know, act normal and not attract any attention. But you'd have to think that people could probably, you know, smell him coming a mile away here, and they started to take interest in him when they saw him, shuffling about, trying to avoid their notice there. And unfortunately for our mate Terrar, he was found out very, very quickly indeed. He was hours and hours away from Neustadt when he was discovered as a French spy. And the main reason for this, of course, is, you know, he's trying to, you know, despite trying to pass himself off as a Prussian peasant, he couldn't speak a word of German. So the disguise fell apart pretty quickly there. So some of the locals there in Prussia, they alert some soldiers who capture Terrar, and they drag him back to the headquarters for questioning. And obviously he's searched and nothing is found. Most suspicious. What is this French bloke doing, you know, behind enemy lines with no secret messages, nothing to indicate that he's a spy or anything else there like that? Very, very suspicious indeed. But Terrar also keeping shtum about all this as well. He's not admitting anything, holding it down very well indeed. So it looks like maybe he is cut out for, you know, to be a spy. He's doing very well indeed. Even when the Prussians bring out the whip and start belting, you know, belting him around with it. Poor old Terah, he's getting a full-on whipping there. He doesn't give in. He holds his ground. And he doesn't say a thing. Eventually, the Prussians have had enough to trying to get this, you know, weird frog mouth stinker to spill the beans. So they drag him to their commander, a bloke named General Zugli, right? German name. Don't even worry about it. Got them one. They got them all covered off. Easy, very easy indeed. Once again, he's questioned. Once again, he keeps his big mouth shut. So they chuck him into the prison. And unfortunately, you know, again, not a very nice part of the story. They continue to torture him. And eventually, after about 24 hours of this, our brave hero, he finally breaks. And, you know, this poor bugger, he spills the beans and he tells them everything. He tells them the whole plan. You know, he says that he's got top secret, highly important military documents up there where the sun don't shine. And in a typically German fashion, the Prussians work out a very efficient and very pragmatic solution. They chain him to a latrine and wait. And wait and wait for further details to emerge. And it is not too long before we've got a code brown. And Terah, he gets on with his second favourite activity in the world. And again, you know, just about blasts himself off into outer space there as he dances the Mexican foxtrot. And in amongst the ravages of the hot snakes is, of course, the little wooden box. And General Zugli, after, I guess, washing it off, you'd imagine, he opens it up. He's hoping to uncover the, you know, the valuable military intelligence that lies inside. But instead, of course, he finds this bloody rubbish that de Beauharnais had written here. And he is furious. He's had to put up with a lot of crap here, both literal and figurative, to try to get his hands on this. And it's obviously a huge, big waste of time. And he's so angry that he nearly executes poor old Terah here. Our mate, he's dragged off the bog and straight to the gallows, where the executioner puts a noose around his neck, right? Imagine that. I mean, as you'd expect, poor Terah, he's weeping and crying pitifully at this point. He's begging for mercy. He's just seconds from death. He never meant to get into anything like this. He just wanted something to eat, this poor bastard. And thankfully, the Prussians, they either have mercy on him or the whole thing was a, you know, big stitch-up for a bit of a laugh. And given that Prussia went on to become modern Germany, I'll let you decide which one of them is the more likely. And they let him down from the gallows. They give him one last thrashing for good measure. They cart him back to the French border and dump him there to go on his way. So pretty bloody close shave for our poor old mate there. And you can imagine it affected him pretty bloody strongly. So strongly, in fact, that when he got back to his superiors to report what had happened, he begged never to have to do any kind of espionage ever again. And given how things had gone, given how he'd, you know, rolled and capitulated once the Prussians had nabbed him, it is not surprising that the French decide, yeah, nah, look, let's give him a spell, eh? But here's where things get a little sad for poor old Terah. Unfortunately, his story is not a happy one at the end of things, as we'll discover very, very shortly here. He goes to Percy and Corville, and quite obviously at the end of his tether, this poor young man, he begs them to cure him of his insatiable hunger. He says, I'll do anything, any treatment at all that you suggest, I'll do it because I'm sick and tired of living my life like this. The poor bloke, he's going around absolutely honking. He can't stop eating. He's always hungry. It'd make you bloody miserable, it would. I'm surprised he got as far as he did while still staying sane, to be honest. I'm never, you know, able to feel properly satisfied or anything. The poor bloke. So he goes to these doctors and they agree they'll try to cure him. And Percy takes over the experiments at this stage, trying to find something that's going to suppress this poor bastard's appetite. Percy gives him laudanum. He gives him tobacco pills. He has him on wine vinegar for a while, but nothing works. Percy even gave him, for some reason, huge amounts of soft-boiled eggs. I don't know what the reasoning was there. I mean, I like a nice boiled egg, although I suppose if I was forced to eat sort of hundreds of them one after the other, I'd never want to eat anything again. So maybe that was the idea there. Anyway, of course, none of this works. And poor old Terah is as hungry as ever. Percy tried to regulate his diet as well and control how much he ate. But Terah, obviously, he couldn't help himself. And he'd keep sneaking out of the hospital to find food. He would rummage through gutters and bins outside the butchers. He's looking for, you know, bits of offal that have been chucked away. Or he'd be fighting, you know, stray dogs for scraps of food in the garbage heaps. It's all very, very sad. I feel very sorry for this poor bloke. And after this, I'm sorry to say, things go from sort of sad to actually quite dark. And I'm actually not going to get into it. It's way, way too full on for, you know, what is supposed to be a lighthearted podcast. And if you want to know the ins and outs of what happened after, you know, after he returned and after he was on this regimen here with Baron Percy here, you're going to have to look it up for yourself. I'm sorry if that seems like a cop out, but it is really nasty stuff and I'm just not comfortable chatting about it here. So we're just going to press on with the story. The long and the short of it is, Tarar's increasingly unhinged behavior as his hunger took over his life actually meant that he was eventually forced out of the hospital and chased away by the staff, because some of the stuff that, you know, he was imagined to have done as a result of this pretty bloody monstrous. And after having been chased away like this, after having been, you know, booted out and sort of run out of town, he disappeared. Disappeared from history for the next 4 years. We've got no idea what he got up to. I mean, we got an idea of, I mean, some of the stuff that he got up to. We can presume he spent a lot of the time chomping his way through vast quantities of food. That much seems like, you know, a safe enough enough assumption. But we don't know for certain for what happened until 1798, when Baron Percy got a message from another doctor, Monsieur Tessier, in a hospital in Versailles, saying that the hospital had a patient that was specifically requesting to see Baron Percy. He wanted to chat to Percy there. And intrigued by this message, Percy made the trip down to Versailles to find, of course, that none other than poor old Tarar was lying there in a hospital bed, crook as a dog, so bloody sick. He was so sick, he was. Now, Tarar told Percy that 2 years ago he had swallowed a golden fork, and that was what was making him sick, and asked Percy to find a way to remove it from inside him. But Percy, unfortunately, he knew that that wasn't the case, and he could very clearly see that the situation was very different and also very grim. Tarar was dying. He had tuberculosis. He had very bad advanced tuberculosis, and he was heading towards an early death as the disease took a stronger and stronger hold of him here. And of course, at this stage, there just wasn't anything that Percy or anyone really could do for poor old Tarar here. He was only 26 years old, and about a month after Percy's visit, his condition only worsened and only got worse and worse and worse until he's in such a bad way that he actually died. He finally died again at the very, very young age, only 26, they estimate his age. Of course, we don't know for sure, but again, very, very young man. But if you thought he had smelt bad when he was alive, Wow, it got worse after he died. No one could be in the same room as his body, as the air was basically unbreathable due to the foul stink that emanated from it. His corpse was so disgusting, so foul and putrid, that the other doctors in Versailles didn't want to dissect it. But Tessier did. Maybe you just wanted to find that bloody golden fork, mate. Obviously worth a fortune. Golden fork inside him. Whew, imagine that. So Tessier opened him up, had a look inside, and oh my goodness me, what an absolute horror show it was. Tarar's corpse had started rotting as soon as he died, and inside it was all gross and disgusting and fetid and just horrible, right? But interestingly, Tarar's mouth and gullet, this is what was sort of discovered as part of this autopsy, his mouth and gullet was so big that if you opened up his mouth, you could see right down into his stomach when you looked down his throat. And his jaws were able to stretch way, way open like a bloody snake. His stomach was huge as well. It was all stretched out, taking up most of his abdomen. And his liver and his gallbladder were also weirdly oversized. So this bloke was obviously, you know, medically unique. He was like nothing anyone had seen before. But unfortunately, the investigation was never properly concluded. This autopsy, this dissection was never properly finished, because the smell became too powerful for even Tessier to put up with. And so he gave up before very much longer. But it did prove something very important. Tarar's condition wasn't psychological. No way could you hope to claim that it was a psychological thing here. It was definitely a physical thing. And even today, we don't really know. We don't really understand what was going on with Tarar, or exactly what, you know, to diagnose him with. There are obviously conditions today, such as polyphagia, that we sort of have something of an understanding of there. But we don't really, you know, this was such an advanced form of that, if it was polyphagia here, that it baffles doctors even today what was going on with this fella. Poor old Tarar. I mean, if you think about it, really, very, very sad story for him here, because he was condemned to a life of unending hunger, this poor bloke. And his tragic story has, you know, a mystifying ending to it, because not only do we not really know what was up with this fella and, you know, why he had the appetite he had, there's another mystery that was never solved due to the autopsy being cut short. That golden fork was never found. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of Tarar, or Tarar, again, a thousand apologies there for the just for general people listening. I mean, it can't be fun listening to me mispronounce every single name under the sun, but you know, that's the way it goes. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this week's show. I certainly, I don't know if you picked up on it, but I certainly very much enjoyed reading about this bloke and sharing his story with you as well. So I hope you got something out of it. But that's it for another week. So it's time for all the boring, usual housekeeping nonsense to close out the show. Halfasthistory.net, that's the website. You can find the contact form there. People getting in touch with you every week. I do appreciate the emails. And I can confirm for you that there are now rock-solid plans in motion to get Half-Assed History merchandise underway. And, of course, the first recipients of that merchandise will be all the Patreon members. So I'll be reaching out to people. I'll be getting in touch with people in the coming months once I've got an idea of exactly how things are going to work. But it will be available for purchase, and I'll be sending stuff out to loyal Patreon members, of course. So if you want to snag some of the merchandise on the cheap right now, best way to do it, sign up for the Patreon, of course, because I'll be sending things out to all of my loyal followers there, and thank you so much to those people who have been, you know, patiently and uncomplainingly chucking me money hand over fist for months on end for absolutely no reason. So I really, really do appreciate that, and I'm gonna try to reward the kindness you've showed me in the coming weeks and months with some merch. And if you've got ideas for merch, please let me know. Thinking at this stage, will there be some t-shirts, maybe some mugs? I'll have a look at what else is feasible and how it's going to work, but I'll be chucking that your way before very much longer. So yeah, please let me know if you've got any thoughts there. If you want to subscribe to the show, best way to do that, of course, is again through the website. Links there for iTunes and Android and Spotify. And if you could do me a favor and just let people know that the show exists, and if you've got friends with particularly puerile senses of humor, this is definitely the one to get them hooked. You know, this is definitely the one to get them on board, because wow. And if you're not a fan of Poo Chat, well, I apologize, and you know, hopefully there won't be too much. Well, hopefully we'll have a little bit more Poo Chat before very much longer, because it was very, very good fun. Anyway, that's enough of that for another week. We've got a question here posed on Reddit to close out the show. We've obviously had a lot of chat about food, a lot of chat about hunger this week. And so a very pertinent question here asked by Reddit historian Ninal56, who wants to know, why do historians call 19th century Austria Hungary?